Thanks, Greg. Yes, we've just caught up with Esa-Pekka Salonen. It's great to have you in Philadelphia.
Thank you. It's very nice to be back.
So was there one musical experience that you had or one piece of music that made you want to compose or conduct?
I had some experiences like that when I was a kid. In terms of music, generally, it was Bruckner 4, actually. I happened to hear it on the radio, and I came in like halfway through the scherzo, and I was completely mesmerized and fascinated by it. And I listened to the end of it, and they said it was the Fourth Symphony by Bruckner. And I said to my mom, I want that on an LP. And she went and bought it for me, and I listened to it until there was nothing left of of the record. In terms of composing, I remember that afternoon very well because I came home from school. My dad had bought his first real stereo system, which was kind of a big deal in those days, and he hadn't installed it properly yet, so it was on the floor of the living room. And I came in and I switched it on, and it happened to be on a classical music channel, and something unbelievable came out of the loudspeakers, and I didn't know what it was, but it was just completely otherworldly and completely mesmerizing. And that was the Turangalila Symphony by Messiaen. I thought, okay, if music can sound like that, I want to be a composer. So that was the impulse.
And I suppose conductors who do not compose are always talking about discovering the composer's intent. So when you conduct your own work, I guess you know the intent, but does that change in the translation when you step on the podium?
This intent thing is actually very difficult, and it's not a straightforward thing. It's not like, okay, I wanted this and that to happen, and if anything else happens, it's not okay. It doesn't work like that. When I listen to, say, Hindemith conducting his own music, there are at least three recordings of the Matisse de Malle symphony, maybe 10 or so years between, and they're totally different. So which one of them is his original intent? I don't think it works like that. I think it's a process for composers as well as the performers. And what happens to me often is that I go and hear a concert of a piece of mine conducted by a colleague, and sometimes I hear things that I didn't even know were there. And sometimes I hear a phrase that is completely different from what I did myself, but very compelling and really fascinating. And I always think, okay, so what we do as composers is that we create a framework, a system of symbols that allows people to express themselves within that framework. And that's why this kind of music is still so much alive. If the whole thing was about seeking some kind of original truth and reconstructing some kind of first performance realism, I think this art form would have died a long time ago. Because what's the point? It's like, this is not archaeology. This is, the whole point is that Beethoven wrote all those notes 200 years ago, and they're still alive because people look at them from their own perspective, from their own life experience, their own time, their own culture, and out comes something that is a mixture of what Beethoven gave and what history has given since Beethoven and what we feel at that very moment.
And does composing inform the way you conduct other people's work?
I'm sure it does. I try to be respectful, sympathetic, because I know it's hard. The best case scenario for me is that I study to a point where I can have an illusion that I wrote the piece myself. Illusion. But it's fun when it happens, because then I feel very free, because I no longer feel that I can violate anything because it's my piece. And that's one of the best feelings I ever have on the podium. And it's totally idiosyncratic, it's totally subjective, and it cannot be measured in any kind of factual way. It's just the way I feel.
Could you talk about the shape of this program? We started out with the wonderful Strauss, Also Sprach Zarathustra, which may be familiar to many, many people, at least the first minute and a half. Then you have so much drama and lilting melodies and evocative sections.
Also Sprach Zarathustra is one of the great orchestral scores of all time. It's incredibly well crafted. The material is fantastic. It's full of very catchy, expressive melodies and moments, and the harmony is brilliant. It's just a great masterpiece. Strauss, as he was one of the leading conductors of his day, kind of trusts the conductor. And a lot of his music is made for hands, if I can use that clumsy metaphor, that when you start conducting Strauss, you really feel that it all comes out of the sort of physical experience of conducting and playing. It's very satisfying to conduct, also very satisfying to play. I mean, people love playing it.
We're about to hear two works by Bartok. So is there anything we should listen for as we go into the second half? Anything in particular, any technique or the way he uses sound?
The Mandarin, the Miraculous Mandarin, is a very fascinating score because there is no system. Bartok was a very systematic composer later in life, and he was very fond of various mathematical structural ideas and also working meticulously with modes and different scales and so on, like mirror images and the golden ratio and all these things. In the Mandarin, it's all like a gigantic jam session. It's almost like an improvisation. And there's no system that binds the notes together. Yet, it makes perfect sense. And yet, every note sounds as if they have to be exactly where they are.
Well, we look forward to it. Among all your other activities and positions, congratulations on your appointment as the San Francisco Symphony's new music director starting in 2020. It's fascinating that I understand you're also creating a collaborative group of 8 artist advisors, which includes people who are musicians and many of them are composers. Among this group of 8 people, there's also an AI entrepreneur and roboticist, is that right?
Robotics expert, yeah. I guess you can say roboticist.
What's the role of this group?
Well, I think when somebody in their 60s takes over a symphonic organization, the idea of somebody of my generation shaping the future of a symphonic organization alone is not a very interesting one. Because obviously, you know, I've been around, I'm very experienced in all this. I know how a symphony orchestra works. But I felt that I needed help in positioning the organization within the community and within the contemporary culture in the sort of wider sense of the word. And I thought, I'm going to ask a number of people whose work I admire and who are younger but already established artists to help me in curating programs and helping in the process of outreach, education, new program ideas, new ways of presenting classical music and contemporary music in the community, new ways of using cutting-edge technology within our art form, and so on. So I just simply felt that I needed help, I needed inspiration, and also I think it would be fun. I've been doing this for decades, and I thought, I'm going to have fun. And how do I have fun? I need kind of intellectual and artistic stimulus. And I'm sure that these 8 people will provide that.
Well, and I read somewhere that you were talking about how it's exciting to take risks, and perhaps we're all curious to see what's next and what the role of music will be in our society and how technology will influence that.
Well, we are at a junction at the moment in terms of what's happening with the technology. There are really fascinating new technologies coming up that are almost there, not quite yet. And I'm talking about the immersive technologies, the virtual reality and augmented reality, and also 360 sound. And all these technologies are going to explode in the next couple of years or so. And I really think that classical music should be in the forefront of using these new possibilities rather than, you know, being reactive and afraid of the new thing. And I told the orchestra in San Francisco that I don't see that anything could ever replace the hardcore of what a symphony orchestra does, i.e. we play wonderful music in live concerts to people. That's what we do, and that's the mission, and that will stay intact, and we keep that integrity going. But there are so many things that you can do to enhance the experience, to look creatively at the very ritual of a symphony concert, to look at the distribution, look at the mediums that we are using, look at the ways artificial intelligence and live music can interact, to look at the ways robots could serve a function in, say, education projects. Imagine human-machine hybrids and what would happen if a pianist had four hands instead of, or five hands instead of two. What would happen if a harpist had 20 fingers instead of 10? And so, you know, the kind of imagine things in a way that we haven't been able to imagine before. And I think that, as with all experiments, some things will work out and some things maybe less so. But I think we have to make those experiments, otherwise we are doomed.
Well, it sounds very exciting. Congratulations on all your activities, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Esa-Pekka Salonen.
Thank you very much.